You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Welcome to episode 261 of Columbia Calling, your weekly podcast on living and working in Colombia. My name is Adrian Alsema of Columbia Reports, and this is the news for week 8, 2019. President Ivan Duque's meeting with his American counterpart Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. has increased military tensions between Colombia and its neighbor, Venezuela. The neighbor's president, Nicolas Maduro, on Saturday ordered the military to step up the presence of troops, tanks, and missiles along the Colombian border in the west and that of Guyana in the east. The United States has increased economic sanctions on Venezuela, and Trump has consistently kept the possibility of a military invasion using Colombia as a launching pad open. Venezuelan opposition leaders have been coordinating actions that seek Maduro's removal from office with top officials in Colombia and the United States. At home, the Duque administration appears to be ending its commitment to many of the state's obligations agreed with now demobilized FARC guerrillas in 2016 to end the country's 55-year-old armed conflict. According to centrist lawmakers, the government's National Development Plan does not include budgets for development in traditional guerrilla territory, the return of stolen land to victims of displacement, or the reparation of the country's 8.5 million war victims. A member of the Truth Commission, the body that seeks to clarify the extreme violence in Colombia of the past decades, said that a 40% budget cut will make it impossible for the entity to investigate crimes against humanity in remote areas where much of the armed conflict took place. Duque's open rejection of the legitimacy of Venezuela's government and the ending of peace talks with the country's last standing guerrilla army, the ELN, have improved the president's approval rating, according to pollster Infamer. The pollster, that has received payments from government institutions, on Friday confirmed other polls that registered a recovery of Duque's approval rating earlier this month. The majority of the population continues to disapprove of the president and his policies, but not as massively as in November when Duque's approval rating plunged to around 25%. According to multiple polls, the president can now count on the approval of approximately 40% of Colombians. There are concerns about the president's possible refusal to sign a statutory law that defines the powers of the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, the war crimes tribunal known as YIP. Duque's party, the Democratic Center, has opposed the peace process since the beginning, and in particular the transitional justice system. The president's political patron, former President Álvaro Uribe, has been accused of being responsible in several of the worst war crimes committed during the conflict. The family members of other prominent Uribistas in Congress have also been tied to war crimes. While the president does not have the power to sink the statutory law, he can send it back to Congress that took more than 2 years to approve the bill that was sent to the presidential palace last week. Weekly Semana said that such a decision would effectively mean the death blow to the transitional justice system and the peace process. The president lacks broad approval to seriously affect the peace process opposed by his party. Duque's coalition does not have a majority in Congress. Former guerrilla leader Timochenko was the first to appear before the War Crimes Tribunal last week for a voluntary hearing on his involvement in the FARC's kidnapping practices. The initial hearing was held behind closed doors, unlike future interrogations in which prosecutors and judges will ask about individual kidnapping cases that directly affect victims. the first hearing of Timochenko and some 30 other FARC leaders who have been called to trial should help the court determine responsibility within the demobilized guerrilla organization. Prosecutors of the War Crimes Tribunal returned to Bogota empty-handed last week after 2 weeks of trying to find out the whereabouts of El Paisa, one of the FARC leaders expected in court next month. El Paisa and the group's political leader, Ivan Marquez, went underground in southern Colombia in July last year. Their whereabouts and that of 8 other mid-level FARC commanders are currently unknown. There are concerns that El Paisa and the other former guerrilla commanders may have rearmed, but this has been denied by the FARC leader's attorney. Marquez and El Paisa have said they continue to support the peace process, but will only come out of hiding if they are given the guarantees they cannot be extradited to the United States on possibly bogus drug trafficking charges. The arrest of longtime FARC ideologue Jesus Santrich on a vague U.S. drug trafficking charge last year caused one of the biggest crises in the peace process so far. An unknown number of former guerrillas and commanders have since gone into hiding. Colombia's Inspector General said he would investigate key members of Medellin's notoriously corrupt elite, including Medellin Mayor Federico Gutierrez and former presidential candidate Sergio Fajardo. The political leaders are suspected of sharing responsibility in an environmental disaster caused by Medellin energy company EPM that virtually dried up Colombia's second largest river, the Cauca, earlier this month. Antioquia's political leaders have been pushing the Ituango hydroelectric dam forward, allegedly in collusion with paramilitary groups and often without approval of national environmental authorities. A Barranquilla mass rapist called Big Bad Wolf was sentenced to 60 years in prison last week for a rape of more than 90 children between 2007 and 2008. The man was arrested in Venezuela in December 2017 on charges that he raped at least 274 children in the Caribbean region of Colombia. According to Semana, the Big Bad Wolf could have raped more than 500 children over the past decade. The prosecution that had the man in custody in 2008 but released him was unable to clarify the vast majority of reported rape cases. 1 in 10 of Colombia's municipalities is without drinking water, the Ministry of Housing and Territory said. More than one-third of the country is at risk of running out of drinking water because of a drought caused by Pacific weather phenomenon El Niño. Scientists have warned that the effects of El Niño and related weather phenomenon La Niña, that brings excessive rains, could become worse as the result of global climate change. This year's El Niño is expected to cause drought throughout Colombia until March, when under normal circumstances the rainy season begins. Death threats against journalists reached an all-time high in 2018, according to Press Freedom Foundation FLIP. In its annual report on press freedom, the FLIP called 2018 the most violent year for journalists, particularly those working for local media. According to the Press Freedom Foundation, more than 477 attacks against media workers took place last year, a 57% increase compared to 2017. Of the cases in which a perpetrator could be established, state officials were the worst offenders. Government and military officials attacked press freedom more than twice as often as all Colombia's narcos and guerrillas combined. That's the end of this week's bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia,
2,600 meters closer to the stars. And yes, we've got finally episode 261, Alex Fatal, anthropologist, academic, writer, back on the show. I know I said he was going to be episode 260. Well, he was, but we had a recording problem. So anyway, I apologize profusely to those of you out there expecting to hear Alex Fatal a couple of weeks ago. But no, we've got him back from central Pennsylvania, Penn State at the moment, and we'll be discussing his book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Colombia. Now, Alex is an expert in Colombia. We've had him on the show before. He was telling us about his project, Shooting Cameras for Peace, where he spent time in some, downtrodden areas of Bogota, cameras, photography, and so on. And you can go back in our archives and find that fascinating interview. But also, I think it's fascinating, I'm repeating myself, but it's fascinating to talk about these things with someone who is so knowledgeable and really did accompany, let's say, the peace accords, not so much as the accords themselves, but also the whole run-in to what brought us to the peace accords. And that's the fruit of that is this book, Guerrilla Marketing. So before I, natter on too much, Alex, welcome on Columbia Calling once again.
Wonderful to be back, Richard. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. Now, just give us a bit of a background to your time in Colombia and why or how this book came about.
Sure. So I came to Colombia in 2001 with a Fulbright grant. And that's when I started shooting cameras for peace in Altos de Cazuca in a neighborhood called El Progreso. And that was just a kind of personal initiative with 30 young people who had been displaced by the conflict or were coming to Bogota for economic reasons. And that project really took off and it became a nonprofit organization, and that lasted for about 7 years. And then I went to graduate school. And when I went to graduate school, I started doing my research on this program called the Program for Humanitarian Attention to the Demobilized, or PAD. And it's a special program within the Ministry of Defense. And essentially, this program, it tries to lure people out of the guerrilla individually. Both the FARC and the ELN tries to pull people out and then essentially ring them for as much information as they can get, providing them with some legal benefits, some basic welfare. And of course, it gives great information to the government in terms of helping them prosecute the counterinsurgency. The problem, and one of the reasons why I criticize this program, is because it doesn't really take people entirely out of the war. It keeps them involved in the conflict, kind of moving them over to the government side, which kind of goes against the ethos of demobilization as a peace-building strategy. You're trying to, generally, you want to get people out of a war and have them no contact with the conflict going forward. So basically, this book is a deep dive. I've researched it for way too long. It's a deep dive into this program, this idea of individual demobilization, and particularly the role that marketing has to play, because the Ministry of Defense partnered with corporate marketers. You know, the company then known as Low SSP 3, now it's Mullen Low SSP 3, but it's the same firm that would steward the brands of Mazda and Red Bull in Colombia. So it very much looks at this partnership between the military and the marketers and how they together have kind of resignified the word demobilization, and how they've kind of conducted this corporatized form of psychological warfare campaigns.
It's really interesting indeed. And of course, you place an example of how these marketing gurus sort of liken selling Mazda to demobilization, which is something that I find kind of difficult to get my head around. But how is it that you got to sit up there in the front row of all of this? So I guess you contacted them saying, "Hey, I'm at grad school. I'm interested in this," and they basically said yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they really anticipated that I would stick around for so long and keep digging around. And they're constantly managing an influx of interest from journalists and foreigners, more so in the civilian side of the program. So the way it's divided is that the Ministry of Defense is in charge of the first two Ds in the DDR of disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. So after, you know, what should be no more than 2.5 months, people who present themselves to a military unit and say they want to turn themselves in, they should be certified and they get an official certification as being demobilized. And then they pass on to the civilian agency, which before the peace agreement was the ACR. Now I believe it's the ARN. So unlike many researchers who would approach via the ACR, I decided to go through the Ministry of Defense because it's really in these first moments of demobilization when, you know, people are still figuring out what the deal is. They're still being squeezed for information. And that dynamic of kind of revealing but withholding, it casts a long shadow over the process. And it was really one of the harder parts to get access to as a researcher. But to the credit of the program, they opened it up to me. And it was actually a confusion with a friend of mine who was who's a political scientist, Abby Steele. She's also been on the show. And she was introduced to a fellow who was in charge of demobilization, where she was interested in displacement. So it was this kind of linguistic slippage between desplazado and desmovilizado, you know, back in the mid-2000s when the priorities within the kind of humanitarian apparatus in Colombia were shifting from the kind of desplazado or displacement crisis of, you know, the late 1990s and early 2000s to, you know, former President Uribe's demobilization policies, whether that was the demobilization of the paramilitaries or this individual demobilization, which really is desertion or defection by another name, both of which have been highly problematic. But there was, you know, a kind of reprogramming that was happening, and then I ended up meeting the guy who was in charge of demobilization. And the first time I saw these focus groups that they were conducting with former guerrillas and trying to understand how they were getting messages within what is otherwise a fairly hermetic world, this kind of bubble that the FARC's fronts have created, I was just fascinated and wanted to know more. And that was in the summer of 2007. So the book comes out in November of 2018. So it's probably an 11-year gestation period there.
That's amazing. And so did you, I mean, deserters or demobilized or so on is DDD, were brought into the Ministry of Defense, wherever they're brought into. Did you get to see the interrogation process, how they squeezed them for information or anything of this, of such like experiences?
No, I never saw an interrogation in process, but I would speak to the military intelligence officers and I would speak with the former combatants. So I get, you know, both sides of the story.
When you talk about the gestation of so many years, I mean, there's so much information in your book. So, I mean, you had plenty of time to let the jigsaw pieces fall into place, and it really does show in the way it's written. And I you know, you got a great write up in the New Yorker magazine, and I've seen some other reviews here and there. But for me, the most important thing is that this is not an academic book that's going to stay on a shelf gathering dust. This is an academic book that bridges the gap between academia and nonfiction, because you've got these inserts which start off each section, which are, you know, detailing the backgrounds of former or demobilizing, reincorporated guerrillas and how they joined up and why they joined up and what was the situation. So it makes it very much a very real, a very tangible piece of text with which to work with, and especially when you're reading, because you put yourself not in their shoes, but you can understand a little more about the conflict, let's say.
I appreciate that. That was certainly the idea. And, you know, Richard, I can't tell you how much was left out. You know, some of the hardest decisions were things that ultimately couldn't make it into the book. But for me, it was very important that these testimonials of the guerrillas themselves played a substantive role. You know, I had a wonderful editor at the University of Chicago Press, and this idea of using testimonials as kind of devices to separate chapters, you know, has been done before. And she was prodding me to, you know, maybe pare them down a little bit, but I was quite insistent that I wanted these testimonials to be a bit expansive, so the readers can get a sense of the trajectory of people's lives in terms of why is it that they joined the guerrillas in the first place? What are the kind of structural factors in the countryside most often that's pushing them to take up arms? The travails within the guerrillas. And then the decision to desert. As one former guerrilla I interviewed said, you know, you don't just present your letter of resignation in an organization like this. You know, leaving is a very complex affair, and you know, could ultimately cost you your life. So those are, you know, inevitably some of the most dramatic stories, and some testimonials is, you know, what is it? What is the moment that forces, you know, that makes people think, okay, it's worth it. I need to get out of here. And then, you know, the travails of reintegration. And so often people will say that, you know, we left one war for another. That, you know, here, oftentimes in cities, because people were most concerned in terms of their own security about their former comrades. So they would oftentimes set up in the marginal neighborhoods of major cities in Colombia. And they would say, they would call those cities the mountain of concrete or the jungle of concrete, because it's in a way another struggle to survive in a very inhospitable atmosphere that, you know, their skills don't necessarily translate well into, you know, with the exception of private security. If there is one sector of the economy that has been particularly good to former combatants, it is in private security. But that's the exception.
Very true indeed. Of course, a problem that's still very present today with the reincorporation of guerrillas into societies, where the government seemed to have a belief at some point that they're all going to be bakers. You know, every story I ever read or saw, they were, you know, there's a former guerrilla setting up a bakery somewhere. What if you don't want to be a baker? I mean, this is the story. And I know there's a lot of talk about former guerrillas and reincorporating guerrillas to be sort of parks, services, national parks and so on. But can they all go into that? I mean, it's this difficulty that is ever present in Colombia. What are you going to do with, and how are you going to treat these people with certain degree of respect?
You know, I think in a way, I think one of the problems is putting such emphasis on their past. I mean, there's all sorts of populations in Colombia that are have difficult pasts and are facing, you know, economically inhospitable conditions. And for both former guerrillas and many people who are, you know, along the poverty line, the courses in the SENA are one of the things that are most popular. I mean, when people would be asked by the government, you know, in terms of some of the feedback, they would say, we want more cupos, we want more places in these SENA courses to learn how to be mechanics, to learn how to kind of learn a trade. And I think the SENA is doing really important work. And I think it begins to close this kind of skills gap. And I think, you know, one of the things that could be done is just really investing even more in the SENA.
I could see that. I can see that working definitely. It's an important institution here in Colombia, giving opportunities to those who don't ordinarily have access to such opportunities. Very interesting so far chatting with you. This is Columbia Calling, chatting to Alex Fattal, anthropologist, academic, writer, Columbia expert. He's up there at Penn State in the moment, central Pennsylvania. He's on the line to us talking about his latest book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Columbia. We're going to take a short break and be right back talking further about this very, very riveting story about how Alex has been able to get the information together and put this book together. And let's talk a bit more in this next segment about the advertising firm and some of the issues that you confronted whilst you were in that position. So we'll take a short break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. As you know, the second segment of the show, episode 261 of the Columbia Calling podcast, we're talking to Alex Fattal up at Penn State in the moment, central Pennsylvania. We've been talking about his book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Columbia. Very, very compelling read, I have to say. Very compelling read. Very, I can feel and see the imagery and the advertising that was used in these campaigns. And this brings me to this advertising company, Low SSP3. They approached the government, or the government approached them to say, we need to change our tactic.
My understanding is that Sergio Jaramillo, when he was vice minister of defense under Santos during the Uribe administration, approached this firm. And as he told me, he said, look, we can't pay you as much as your corporate clients, but you will win all of the awards. And that prognosis was entirely correct. This firm has won awards from Cannes to New York, Barcelona to Tokyo. I mean, I think well over 100 awards for all the different campaigns they've done for the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, it's been great for their own marketing, right? There's all these recursions of marketing. Here I am marketing my book. I hope you guys will all go out and buy it for your mates in the UK. It's now available. And, you know, the marketing firm is marketing themselves.
Of course.
The government is, marketing this notion that the Ministry of Defense is now a kind of humanitarian organization. It's a benevolent entity that's concerned for the welfare of these guerrillas that it would otherwise be out trying to kill. Of course, this stands in stark contrast to all the various human rights scandals, not least of which is the false positive scandal. But, there are all these layers of marketing. And what was so interesting doing the research was just the level to which the marketers themselves identified with the counterinsurgency mission, that there was this kind of fusion of the two worlds, the two types of expertise, generals and executives. And, central to the book is this idea of brand warfare, and that, if we take branding, that is really a way of managing the intangible assets of a commodity, right? It's a way of building value, of occupying mind share and heart share. And you layer that onto the counterinsurgency mission of winning hearts and minds. The two kind of have an ideological affinity. And this program really kind of turned up the juice on that ideological affinity and really brought the two together. And when they were first conducting the research, these marketers, they got access to the demobilized. And when I interviewed Miguel Sokolov, who is one of the more visible partners in the firm, he says, look, the government gave us something they never gave anybody else, which was access to the demobilized. And, this is kind of the most, secretive source that they have. It's the way that they learn about what the radio codes are that the guerrillas are communicating with. It's the way they learn about, the psychological profiles of its leaders. And in a way, they were opening that up and allowing the marketers to do their own research. And their research was really parallel, you know, very similar to the types of research that a sociologist or an anthropologist might do. It's not a matter of getting tactical intelligence of like, where are they so I can bomb them, but it's a matter of understanding what some people call, you know, insurgency culture, or it's understanding the kind of softer dimensions and the motivations of people who join, right? And so out of that study came the slogan, Hay otra vida, la desmovilización es la salida. This was this idea of kind of creating a backdoor within the insurgency for people to leave. And it was born out of the insights, a word that they'll use in English, by the way, that's part of a kind of transnational public relations speak. It was born out of this insight that, you know, people within the FARC don't view it as a terrorist organization, of course. I mean, they view it as a life choice. You know, they were, many times they joined very young. Maybe they joined because family members had joined. Maybe they joined because they had, you know, that they liked a girl or a guy who was in the guerrilla who was coming through town. They're very kind of personal decisions, and especially as they spend more time in the guerrillas, they often come to see it as, you know, a justified decision. So rather than trying to delegitimize the armed struggle, which is the kind of ideological reflex of, you know, the kind of counterinsurgency discourse, they tried to speak to them on a more human level. And that's where all of the campaigns would inevitably focus, would be trying to attack their hearts, as they would say, and kind of motivate them emotionally to abandon their comrades. You know, the academic literature on civil wars has been quite clear that oftentimes there's a kind of displacement of the affective feelings you have for your family, your kin, your brothers, your sisters, and it's then projected onto your comrades. So your comrades become your new family. But of course, your old ties, your family ties, are latent. They're never entirely displaced. And so these campaigns, like the cover of the book itself, which is the 2013 Christmas campaign, it says, "Antes de ser guerrillera o guerrillero, eres mi hija, eres mi hijo. Before being a guerrilla, you are my child," and using photographs from their mothers and to try to lure them out and call them out. So, I've given you a very long
That's
answer.
Absolutely fine. But so I think that's nice. I mean, you've got the on the front of the book that other campaign, and then there's of course the one, the Operation Christmas, where I guess the army sort of lowered in however many sort of Christmas decorations into a Christmas tree in the middle of the jungle that was lit up, wasn't it? And every time a gorilla came near it, it would light up. Is that right?
Yeah, that was the initial campaign in 2010, and that made, you know, huge headlines in the West, and it really highlighted the sense of kind of creativity and innovation that were, you know, characteristics that the military was in great need of being associated with. It kind of, you know, illuminated this dark space of rebel-controlled territory. And it showed, you know, the benevolent side of the armed forces. I do a whole kind of symbolic analysis of, you know, the light and the dark in the chapter. And then we see the same themes kind of remediated in subsequent chapters. And it's the 2011 campaign, Rivers of Light, where they take these kind of adornments that you might see on a Christmas tree, these round balls, and they place little messages in them and send them floating down the river, perhaps a less coherent campaign than the Christmas tree of 2010. But I get in and follow that one. And then the next year was Operation Bethlehem, where they send a giant anti-aircraft light that's supposed to guide deserters into to the cities and show them the way out of the insurgency. You know, all very kind of evocative, visually compelling stuff. But one of the things that I try to highlight, in addition to the kind of symbolic analysis of these campaigns themselves, is to say that the hyper visibility of these campaigns is accompanied by the secrecy of the intelligence aspect, and the two can't be understood separate from each other. These are kind of two sides of the same coin, and that's why I juxtapose a chapter called Operation Genuine next to the chapter on Operation Christmas. And Operation Genuine is this kind of targeted demobilization operation looking to get a particular comandante de frente out of the Caribbean block. And so, you know, how they go through his sister to find him and put a tracking device in the gifts that she was bringing. So, you know, these are two very different types of demobilization strategies. And, you know, on the one is, I'm arguing, targeting a very wide set of publics. And the other is, you know, trying to, you know, hone in on the individual, right? Which is utterly resonant with kind of ideas of drone warfare, right? Where you're in this kind of 21st century hunting practice where you're looking for to get to influence and to persuade, you know, to kill in the case of the drone, but a particular individual. And the sense that we can target and we can micro-target is absolutely central to the pot. They had an entire unit that was focused on getting at these middle commanders, because the thought from a counterinsurgency's perspective is if they could create a rupture in the command and control structure, they could really degrade the insurgency. So these kind of middle commanders, these comandantes de frente, became quite crucial.
And I have this question for you, because I recall all of this, these advertising campaigns, and of course the very visible one of President Santos and leaning over the boat's edge and dropping his adornment in the rivers of light. But is Colombia amongst, or is it the first country to really employ advertising, you know, to counter an armed conflict in this fashion, or has it happened elsewhere?
I mean, the history of advertising is really wrapped up with the history of warfare, right? In a way, this program is the crystallization of a much longer history. You know, Madison Avenue, of course, really only emerges after World War I. You had the Committee on Public Information in the United States that brought together some of the top journalists and intellectuals and academics. And then after the war, a lot of those people left and founded some of the firms on Madison Avenue. So there's been this kind of co-evolution of war and advertising through the 20th century. But, you know, what I think is interesting about the Colombian case is the way that they're utterly integrated. You know, no longer is this like one giving feedback into the other, but rather the two kind of coming together, you know, explicitly in this joint project. You know, in World War II in the United States, we see you know, the advertising industry getting behind selling war bonds to try to support the war effort in the United States, which is important, but still kind of on the edges of the central war effort. Here, what I'm calling brand warfare is occurring at, you know, really at the center of a war. You know, a guerrilla war is ultimately all about information. And so the fact that they've taken these marketers into their confidence to, you know, help them get these defectors and try to get what is ultimately sacred to the national security state, which is human intelligence. So I don't think it's unique, but I think it's a kind of unique crystallization of a kind of longer set of relationships.
Sort of two parallel subjects, but finally, let's say they're being soldered together in the Colombian arena, I would say. It's sort of, they've been running parallel to one another, sort of touching every now and then, but this time we see them fully fused, I think, as you say. Now, I want to also touch on the point, because you do raise it on a few occasions in your book, that you spend a lot of time with the advertising gurus, the company, and you spent a lot of time with the Ministry of Defense and the soldiers there. And they start seeing you as, I guess I could say, one of their own. They're asking for your feedback on these things and start to feel wronged by you a little bit because you say, no, I'm objective in this. How did you deal with this?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the challenges of doing this research is, you know, in a way, coming in as a foreigner is helpful because I'm not marked politically in the way as somebody who is Colombian doing this research would be immediately marked. I remember I gave a presentation at the Universidad de Antioquia in Medellin, and a guy came up to me afterwards. He said, well, how did you do this research? If I knocked on that door, I would immediately be investigated. So, you know, I think my outsider status helped, but I think there was also presumption that, you know, since I was an American and since there was all this American support for the counterinsurgency, that I would necessarily be sympathetic and, you know, give feedback or ideas. And, you know, particularly given the recent history of kind of collaboration that has happened between social scientists and the U.S. military, there's been a whole ethical discussion in the field of anthropology, and I've signed on to a network of concerned anthropologists about, you know, the instrumentalization and kind of exploitation of anthropological knowledge for war-making purposes. So I really had to hold a very hard line on not collaborating, not providing feedback. But that, of course, made the relationship kind of one-way street. So, you know, I would occasionally buy people lunch, but in the end, there was a kind of lack of reciprocity that made things a little bit hard to navigate. But, you know, I think in the end, people understood that I was not looking to have a scoop. I was not, you know, I was looking to get to the truth. And I had the book is very critical of the program, but I was not, you know. I don't know. I think I approached it very earnestly, and I tried to, you know, give everybody their say.
When you compiled and was it, were able to get the interviews with the demobilized, you went to their safe houses to talk to them, or you had to, go with the military. How could you conduct these interviews?
In the beginning, I started in the safe houses where they're waiting to be certified. So, and that's a particularly difficult moment. I mean, these houses are kind of dens of intelligence and counterintelligence, as the guerrillas will send people to the falsely demobilized and kind of get information on who's left. Mm. So that was difficult research, but just the kind of personal relationship that would strike up there, and then following people after they were certified and getting to know people's families and their circumstances, and just kind of very gradually building relationships, and then having, you know, some of these former rebels introduce me to others. I would travel to different parts of the country, and you know, just gradually built a network of people who had recently deserted mostly from the FARC, but also the ELN.
Well, I'm sure they treated you with a certain degree of mistrust. This CIA agent is down here trying to get information.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, there's distrust everywhere in this world. This distrust is one of the biggest byproducts of the Colombian conflict. But in terms of the former rebels themselves, I mean, their most immediate concern was that I wasn't affiliated with the guerrillas. And, you know, my accent, the way I walk, there's no shortage of signs that make it clear that I was not with the guerrillas. So, you know, I think that enabled them to lower their guard. But it was really only the kind of time that I would spend with them, getting to know them, that would, you know, allow them to understand that I was not working on behalf of any government.
Mm. Definitely. Now, with this this book, The Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Colombia, it's, you know, largely it's about message, it's about marketing. And this brings me to the point of President Santos, the former president, failed or, you know, voted down referendum back after peace was signed the first time, and the big, you know, brouhaha in Cartagena. Of course, you remember the jets going overhead and Timoshenko ducking. I mean, President Santos was clearly poorly advised and hadn't had the help or the advice of low SSP3 on how to get that message to each, let's say, each demographic, would you say?
Yeah, no, actually, low SSP3 was, at that point, it was Mullen Low Group, but they were involved in crafting an advertisement for the C campaign.
And I didn't know.
This girl who's supposedly born on October 2nd, who's going to be the first Colombian born to peace, and they had this whole thing around this girl by the name of Juliana, and it was this kind of, you know, touch at your heartstrings type of campaign. It was like on October 3rd, Colombians woke up, and it was a new country, and it was getting over its historical hang-ups, and it was... To watch this advertisement on the real October 3rd, 2016 was really quite jarring, you know, which raises the point that I'm not trying to create the impression that they were entirely successful campaigns. I think the program of individual demobilization was effective at a counterinsurgency level in terms of collecting information, but, you know, I think it comes with medium and long-term consequences. And I think the kind of skepticism that was built up to the term demobilization that, you know, started back in the Uribe years, that demobilization just turned into another set of tools to be used for political and military advantage, whereas, you know, these are supposed to be neutral peace-building tools. So I think, you know, these types of things will kind of can come back and nip you in the bud. So, yeah, I mean, the plebiscite will go down in history as this spectacular failure. And, you know, everybody will have their own analysis as to why it ended. But, you know, when you look at the types of campaigns, including the one advertisement made by Mullen Low, SSP3, they were really betting the house on this universalist message of peace that, you know, when ultimately the population was forced to choose between war and peace, you know, that more pacifist minds would win out. But there was a kind of micro-targeting of more specific publics with more divisive messages. And this is part and parcel of a wider moment of disinformation, digital platforms, and that was pretty persuasive. So, you know, I don't know if I had met, you know, light to shed. I was an observer of the plebiscite like everybody else was. I didn't really have any research insights into it. But the book ends in the epilogue. And the epilogue is, you know, the FARC are trying to do their own marketing. They had a stage fit for the Rolling Stones in the Sabana de Jari, their southern stronghold, and they were having these concerts with national acts, and they had swag, they had merchandise, they had tote bags, they had baseball caps and mugs, you know. And I think, you know, the book ends on a note, not to give too much away, I hope people will buy it, but, you know, the book ends on this note that there's a real danger in terms of allowing the central questions of war and peace and statecraft to be conducted through marketing. That, you know, this is a system that may be capitalism's meaning-making system. It might be, you know, what we're used to, but it's a system of largely hollow signifiers. It's to say, you know, Coca-Cola is the real thing. Okay, well, what the hell is real? What thing is it? What kind of sugary beverage are we talking about? And these kinds of, you know, constant, you know, the misinformation that happens through advertising, you know, to allow that to sit at the center of governing, to sit at the center of determining questions of war and peace, I think, is really problematic. And so the book, on another level, is kind of a warning call to say, we need to rethink this.
Well, I would say so too. And of course, you address these issues, and it's kind of like this unspoken or unwritten. It's what's behind your text. There's this doubt always, and which brings me to the final sort of things I want to say here. And now we've got the new, well, relatively new government of Iván Duque, who is on the outlook. He doesn't look too friendly, or doesn't have people around him who are particularly friendly to the press and aren't particularly friendly. And his marketing machine is very different. Do you have any thoughts about this new Duque government in this respect?
I mean, you know, charisma is not transferable. So President Uribe, he can't really transfer his charisma to Duque. And the fact that Santos managed to pull off a peace agreement with the FARC with, you know, the real paucity of charisma that he had was a big accomplishment. I don't know. I have great skepticism about Duque's abilities to lead the country. I mean, I think he's just in over his head. that's my expert analysis.
You're not alone. You're not alone in thinking that. It just is. We stumble from one week to the next. But so let me take this moment to thank you again, Alex Fattal, for coming back on the show after we had errors and problems in recording, and coming back to talk again about your book, Guerrilla Marketing, Counterinsurgency and Capitalism in Colombia. It's a fascinating read. I recommend it to anyone out there. It's not just a piece of academia. It's a piece of nonfiction that can be read to better understand, let's say, the conflict, but also the closing, the years that led up to the peace agreement with the FARC. So go out there and get it. Buy it online. It's on Amazon. It's in the bookstores. I don't know where else is it available, Alex. Everywhere.
Well, you can get the online version within 5 minutes, but it's now available in Europe, and we're working on a Spanish translation.
Excellent. Well, I hope you come down to launch it and have a conversation with your fans down here, because of course it's as you say, it's a warning, it's a wake up call to this. I think the word is that you had, and it's someone else's word, is militainment that's taking place. Was it Stahl?
Yeah, Roger Stahl.
Roger Stahl. Militainment. Okay, well, so we'll close off this episode 261 of Columbia Calling. It's been a great episode with Alex Fattal up there at Penn State. Thank you, Alex, for your time. We'll be back next week. I hope to have a further interviewee talking about their research, another academic who has, as yet, as on previous episodes, remained unnamed for security reasons. But maybe now that she's back in Canada, she can talk to us and actually reveal her name. So we'll sign off this week and leave you hanging with that that piece of information. Thank you again to Alex Fattal. This is episode 261 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Get in touch with us at columbiacalling@gmail.com. We're on Facebook as well, and of course Twitter at Columbia Calling. We'll be posting all the links to Alex's book there too, so you can find a way of getting it. You have no excuse. Thank you again, and bye-bye.